£500! You paid real money for this barren wasteland, foolish girl!
Laugh all you want, Your Grace.
Duke sold her a useless, barren wasteland. For £500 one year later, she discovered gold on it. On a gray, frozen morning in Yorkshire, Duke Benjamin Miller threw his head back and laughed a loud, cruel sound that rolled across the frozen mud like thunder. In his gloved hand, he held a royal deed. At his feet lay a waterlogged, barren wasteland that his own professional surveyors had already declared completely worthless. He had just sold every last inch of it to Cheryl Dawson for £500, every shilling she had left in this world. He turned to his attorney, made a remark, and the whole group laughed. Then he wrote something in his personal ledger that day. He described Cheryl Dawson as a foolish woman who paid good money for a pit of mud. But Cheryl said nothing. She simply gripped the iron key, stood completely still in that freezing mud, and looked at the land with an expression nobody in that group could read. Stay with me, because what Cheryl found beneath that soil, and what she did before the Duke ever found out, is a story you will not forget. Welcome to Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles. If you're ready for stories where the unexpected happens, where the forgotten rise and the underdogs turn the game around, hit that subscribe button now. You don't want to miss what's coming next. Drop a comment below and tell me your name, where you're watching from, and what's on your mind. Your name might be the one called out at the start of the next story. Like, share, and hit that notification bell so you never miss the drama, the revenge, and the secrets waiting to be uncovered. Welcome to the family. Now, let's dive in. The village of Ashwick did not mourn the Dawson name. It simply forgot it. That was perhaps the cruelest thing a small northern village could do to a family. Not condemn them loudly, not whisper about them with sharp pleasure, but simply cease to mention them at all. The way a fire stops producing heat once the last log has burned down to nothing. The Dawsons had once been gentry in the loose, struggling sense of the word. Not wealthy, not connected to London society or to the fashionable estates of the South, but respectable, which, in the northern counties of early 19th century England, was a currency that kept a family fed and a daughter marriageable. That respectability died the same winter Cheryl's father did. Cornelius Dawson had spent 31 years working as a surveyor for landed estates across the Northern Territories. He was a precise, methodical man with ink-stained fingers and an extraordinary eye for what lay beneath the surface of the earth. He had surveyed bogs and plateaus, rocky hillside parcels, and flooded lowland strips. And in all those years, he had developed a private theory, a conviction he shared only with his daughter, who sat beside him at the wooden table in their cottage while he annotated his journals in the candlelight. Cornelius believed that the surface of the earth was a liar, that what a man saw when he stood atop a patch of ground told him almost nothing about what was happening underneath. The clay beds of the northern highlands, he said, were particularly deceptive. Centuries of mountain runoff had been moving across those landscapes since before memory, carrying with it microscopic flecks of mineral wealth and depositing them in thick, slow-moving layers beneath the silt and mud. Most surveyors, he explained, looked at the surface. They measured gradients. They assessed drainage. They noted what grew and what did not. And they stopped there. Cornelius Dawson did not stop there. His journals, 14 of them, bound in worn brown leather and filled with his cramped, technical script, contained observations, diagrams, geological sketches, and soil analyses that no paying client had ever asked for, and no estate agent had ever valued. They were his private work, his true work. He had passed that knowledge to Cheryl the way a craftsman passes a trade to an apprentice, not through formal instruction, but through proximity and patience, through long hours of walking land together and asking her what she noticed, and then asking her what she noticed beneath that. She had been 22 when he died, leaving her with those 14 journals, a worn set of surveying instruments, a crumbling cottage that was not fully theirs to begin with, and £500 held in a small wool pouch inside a locked tin box under the floorboards. It was everything. It was also almost nothing. Ashwick was not unkind to Cheryl Dawson in a direct way. The village simply did not know what to do with a young woman of diminished standing who had no male guardian, no suitor, and no obvious path forward. The local curate's wife had once suggested, gently, that Cheryl might consider applying for a position as a lady's companion in one of the larger houses toward Harrogate. Cheryl had thanked her and quietly changed the subject. The position of companion sitting beside a wealthy woman, reading aloud, fetching shawls, agreeing pleasantly with whatever opinion was offered, was not something Cheryl Dawson's mind could survive. She was not built for agreeable uselessness. She was built for looking at the ground and knowing what was underneath it. For 2 years after her father's death, she read his journals until the ink was familiar to her as scripture. She studied the geological maps he had drawn of the surrounding countryside and compared them with official survey records she accessed at the county registrar's office, where the clerk regarded her presence with mild bafflement, but did not refuse her. She was patient. She was exact. And she was waiting not for rescue, not for a husband, not for sympathy from a village that had already moved on without her, but for a single, specific, and very particular opportunity. It arrived in the form of a notice, posted on the board outside the registrar's office on a Tuesday morning in October, beneath a gray sky that had not fully decided whether to produce rain. The notice was brief. It announced that the outer parcels of the Miller estate, several tracts of northern land held by the Duke of Aldenmere, Benjamin Miller, were being offered for private sale to relieve certain administrative burdens of the estate. The language was careful and clean in the way that legal language tends to be, when the truth behind it is considerably less clean. Anyone who understood the affairs of the Miller estate, and by this point, several people in the county understood them quite well, though none said so openly, knew that the administrative burdens referred to were debts, serious debts. The kind that had been accumulating through the London gambling establishments that the Duke frequented, with the particular enthusiasm of a man who believed that fortune would eventually reward his confidence if he simply applied enough of it. Duke Benjamin Miller was 34 years old, tall, broad-shouldered, and possessed of the kind of physical authority that has nothing to do with character, and everything to do with how a man was raised to enter a room. He had inherited the dukedom at 26 after his father's death, and had proceeded to spend the better part of 8 years enjoying it at a pace that no estate, however generously provisioned, could reasonably sustain. The gambling was not the whole of it. There were also the London townhouse expenses, the racing debts, the costs of entertaining at a level that his shrinking income could no longer support, and the singular unwillingness which was perhaps his most defining characteristic to make the kind of quiet adjustments that a sensible man in his position would have made years ago. His estate manager, a grim, efficient man named Aldous Vane, had been presenting the Duke with increasingly alarming ledger assessments for the better part of 3 years. Vane was not a man given to emotion, which was both his professional value and his personal limitation. He delivered bad news the way a surgeon delivers a cold instrument without warmth and without apology. The outer parcels of the estate, he had informed the Duke, were a liability. They produced nothing. They required periodic boundary maintenance. They drew on the estate's diminishing resources without returning a single shilling to the accounts. Selling them would not solve the larger problem, but it would create breathing room. It would buy time. The Duke had waved a hand and told Vane to arrange it. He had not looked at those parcels himself in over 4 years. He did not need to. His surveyors had assessed them on acquisition, and again 3 years prior, and both assessments had arrived at the same conclusion. Waterlogged, rocky, structurally poor, and entirely incapable of supporting meaningful agriculture or development. One of the northern parcels, a broad, muddy valley running between two low ridges in the Yorkshire Highlands, had been described by the survey report as a marshland of no productive value. The report recommended either sale at minimal price or simple abandonment if no buyer presented. The Duke had never visited it. He had no reason to. Cheryl Dawson read the notice a second time, and then folded it carefully and placed it in the pocket of her gray wool dress. She walked home through the village without stopping to speak to anyone, sat down at her father's table, and spread open the third and seventh of his journals side by side. Then she retrieved the geological maps she had spent 2 years cross-referencing and laid them flat across the table. She worked for the better part of that evening and into the following morning, comparing her father's private soil assessments of the surrounding highland terrain with the topographical contours of the parcels listed in the notice. She was not guessing. She was reading evidence that had been sitting in those journals for over a decade, evidence that no one had valued because it had been compiled by a disgraced, underpaid surveyor whom the county estates had eventually stopped hiring. Her father had walked that valley. He had written about it in the 7th Journal, a detailed, careful entry spanning 4 pages, accompanied by a cross-section sketch of the valley's subsurface clay composition. He had noted the unusually dense concentration of heavy silt at the base of the valley floor, the particular gradient of the surrounding ridges, and the pattern of seasonal water movement across the terrain. He had written, in his cramped and precise hand, that the alluvial conditions of this valley were consistent with the type of natural gold-trapping geology he had observed in 2 other northern highland locations, one of which had, years after his survey, produced a modest but confirmed yield for a private mining operation. He had noted it, filed it in his journal, and never been paid to investigate further. Cheryl closed the journal, sat back in her chair, and looked at the candle flame for a long moment. Then she retrieved the tin box from beneath the floorboards. The meeting was arranged through a letter sent to Aldous Vane, who communicated the buyer's interest to Duke Benjamin with the same flat efficiency he applied to everything. The Duke received the information at his breakfast table, where he was reading a London Gazette and consuming a quantity of coffee that Vane privately considered excessive for a man with the Duke's temperament. A Miss Cheryl Dawson, Vane explained, had expressed interest in the Northern Valley parcel and was prepared to offer £500 in full, immediate payment. The Duke set down his coffee. £500 was not, in absolute terms, a large sum for a parcel of land, even a useless one. But it was immediate. It was in hand. And Vane had pointed out, with characteristic directness, that no other inquiries had been received regarding that particular parcel in the 6 weeks since the notice was posted. The Duke considered this for slightly less time than it would have taken most men to think it through properly. Then he told Vane to arrange the signing. The transaction took place on a Wednesday morning at the edge of the valley parcel itself, which was the Duke's preference. He liked the theatrical quality of meeting on the land being sold, as though his presence transformed the occasion into something grander than it was. He arrived in his carriage with Aldous Vane, his personal attorney Reginald Frost, a spare, cold-faced man who carried his legal folio as though it contained the terms of someone's execution, and a wealthy acquaintance, Lady Dorothea Wyndham, who had accompanied the Duke from a nearby estate visit and was present for no professional reason other than her own amusement. Cheryl walked to the meeting. She arrived precisely on time, wearing her plain slate-gray wool dress, her father's surveying satchel carried over one shoulder, her dark hair pinned back without ornament. The valley opened out behind her as she approached the group, a wide, bleak stretch of frozen mud and gray silt, litched with patches of standing water between ridges of cold brown stone. The sky overhead was the color of old pewter. Somewhere in the ridge above, a bird called once and went quiet. The Duke looked at her, and the expression that crossed his face was one she had expected and prepared for. It was not cruelty exactly. It was something more casual than cruelty. It was the specific amusement of a man who has encountered something so far below his category of concern that he finds it briefly entertaining rather than offensive. Reginald Frost spread the document on the flat of a portable writing board and indicated the signature line without speaking. Cheryl read the contract in full. She read it slowly and without apology for the time this took, and she read every clause, including those relating to mineral rights, at which point she found what she had been looking for, a standard clause referencing the applicability of Crown Charter provisions to the relevant Northern Territory, a clause which Frost had included as a formality, and which the Duke had certainly never read. She signed her name in clean, clear strokes. Frost witnessed it. Vane countersigned. The Duke took the completed contract, glanced at it once, and turned to make a remark to Lady Dorothea, who produced the quiet smirk of a woman watching someone's misfortune from a comfortable distance. The Duke then said something further, something directed at the valley itself, at the gray mud and the standing water, and the small group laughed in the way that people laugh when someone powerful validates their instinct to look down. Cheryl received the iron key from Vane's gloved hand without expression. She wrapped her fingers around it and held it at her side. She did not speak, did not react, did not look at the Duke again. She looked at the valley. The Duke's carriage departed. The sound of the wheels on the frozen track faded north. The bird on the ridge called again. Cheryl stood alone in the mud, holding the key to 500 acres of what every credentialed professional in the county had agreed was completely worthless ground, and she allowed herself, very briefly, the smallest and most private of smiles. The stone hut at the eastern edge of the valley had not been occupied in what appeared to be several years. The roof was intact, which was the primary requirement. The walls were 2 feet thick, and had survived the Yorkshire winters in the honest, indifferent way that old stone survives everything not comfortably, but stubbornly. Cheryl cleared it in a single day, hauling out debris, patching the worst gaps in the mortar with a mixture she prepared herself, and installing the small iron stove she had transported from Ashwick on a hired cart along with her father's journals, her surveying instruments, 2 months of provisions, and a narrow rope-strung bed frame. She told no one in the village what she intended to find on the land. She told no one, in fact, anything at all beyond the simple statement that she was moving to manage her new property. The reaction in Ashwick was a mixture of pity and mild bewilderment, which suited her perfectly. Pity produced inattention, and inattention was exactly what she needed. She began her testing the morning after she moved in, when the sky was still the deep gray of pre-dawn and the valley floor was locked under a thin, crackling sheet of overnight frost. She worked from the methodology her father had described, not beginning at the surface, but sinking test cores into the clay beds using a weighted iron rod she drove into the frozen earth by hand. The work was slow and brutally physical. The upper layers of the valley floor were dense with compacted silt and gravel, and each core sample had to be extracted, marked, and examined in the thin morning light before the frost made the silt unworkable again. For the first 4 days, she found nothing beyond what the survey reports had already described. Waterlogged clay, gray silt, scattered river gravel. The kind of ground that said nothing and offered nothing. She recorded everything in her own notebook without frustration and without revision of her hypothesis. Her father had taught her that patience in geological work was not passive. It was a form of precision. You did not stop because the early results were quiet. You continued to the depth where the quiet ended. On the fifth day, at a core depth of approximately 3 feet below the main clay bed in the lower valley section, the light caught something in the sediment tray. Cheryl set the tray flat on the frozen ground and crouched over it in the early morning stillness. She did not move for nearly a full minute. Then she removed her outer glove, reached into the tray with bare fingers, and lifted a single, small, heavy flake of dense yellow metal no larger than her thumbnail from the gray silt. She held it in her palm and looked at it. Then she put it in her coat pocket, drove the test rod back into the earth at a point 2 feet further down the valley, and continued working. Halvard Crewe was 61 years old and had been a blacksmith for 40 of those years, the last 6 of which had been spent in a semi-abandoned forge on the western edge of a hamlet called Gryfen, 4 miles from Cheryl's valley. He had been cast out, that was the word people used, cast out from his previous position as the primary smithy for a large estate outside Skipton after a dispute with the estate steward over unpaid wages. The dispute had been decided against Halvard by the local magistrate, who was a personal acquaintance of the steward, and Halvard had left the proceeding with neither his wages nor his professional standing and a comprehensive understanding of how justice functioned in the county when one of the parties owned land and the other did not. He was not bitter about it in a consuming way. He was bitter about it in the quiet, settled manner of a man who has placed a piece of knowledge in a reliable location inside himself and simply lives with it. He kept his forge operational through occasional work repairs, ironwork, general fabrication for local farmers, but he took on little, and was known, politely, as a man who had seen better days. Cheryl had learned of him through her father's journals, in which Cornelius had noted Halvard's name in connection with an old mining operation near Skipton, observing that the man had a particular facility for producing heavy-duty ironwork to specific tolerances. That entry was 9 years old. Cheryl had verified through a single careful inquiry in Grafen that Halvard Crewe was still there, still working his forge, and still not talking much to anyone. She walked to Grafen on a Thursday, arrived at the forge in the late morning, and stated her business without introduction or preliminary conversation. Halvard listened to her in complete silence. He was a large, weather-beaten man with the particular stillness of someone who has learned to hear people out before deciding what to do with what they are saying. When she finished, he looked at her for a long moment. Then, at the small cloth pouch she had placed on the workbench beside her, the pouch that contained three of the gold flakes she had extracted from the valley's clay beds over the previous week, he opened the pouch, tipped the flakes into his palm, and examined them without speaking. Then he looked up. She told him what she needed: heavy iron sluice pans, modified gold washing trays, a specific type of sluice box with iron riffles along the base to trap settling heavy metals during water separation. She told him she needed them fabricated quietly, transported without attention, and that she would not be able to pay in full until the operation produced sufficient yield to cover materials and labor. What she offered instead was a written agreement, drawn in her own hand and witnessed by no one other than the two of them, giving Halvard Crewe a fixed percentage of all gold recovered from the valley for the duration of the mining operation, a figure that, if the deposit proved as rich as her father's analysis suggested, would represent more money than the estate steward in Skipton had denied him several times over. Halvard looked at the agreement. He looked at the gold flakes again. He folded the agreement once, placed it inside his coat, and told her he would need 2 weeks to begin the first pieces, and that he would need her to stop standing in his forge and let him get to work. Cheryl walked back to the valley in the gray afternoon light, and for the second time since she had arrived on this land, she allowed herself something that was not quite a smile, but was very close to one. If you're still here after all that, it shows you find the story interesting. And if you are not yet part of the Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles family, hit that subscribe button right now. Because what is coming next, what Cheryl discovers beneath the frozen earth, and what she does before the Duke finds out, is the part of this story that changes everything. Also, drop a comment telling me what you think about the story so far. It takes 10 seconds, and it means more than you know. The best part of this story hasn't even started yet. The first week of December arrived in the Yorkshire Highlands, without announcement and without mercy. The temperature dropped in the night, the kind of drop that did not announce itself gradually but simply arrived between 1 hour and the next, transforming the valley floor from heavy, workable mud into something closer to iron. Cheryl woke each morning before first light and dressed in every layer she possessed: the wool dress, a flannel underskirt, a heavy knitted vest her father had worn on outdoor surveys, and a thick oilskin coat she had purchased secondhand from a departing farmhand in Ashwick before she left the village. She bound her hands in strips of wool cloth beneath her work gloves, which helped with the cold but reduced her dexterity enough that certain tasks, the careful extraction of core samples, the handling of small sediment specimens, required her to remove the outer wrapping and work with bare fingers in temperatures that made her hands ache to the bone within minutes. She did not stop. She noted the pain, accommodated it, and continued. The sluice equipment that Halvard Crewe delivered in 3 separate cartloads across the first fortnight of December was heavy, precise, and exactly what she had specified. Halvard transported it himself in the early morning hours, taking back routes between Grafen and the valley to avoid the main road, covering the ironwork with feed sacking in the cart bed. He did not explain himself to the handful of people who saw the cart pass, and nobody asked. A traveling blacksmith moving ironwork across the countryside was not a notable event in the northern counties, and Halvard's particular quality of silence tended to discourage curiosity. Setting up the first sluice run in the lower valley required 2 full days of preparation in temperatures that hovered just above freezing during the brief midday period and dropped sharply below it in the early afternoon. Cheryl and Halvard worked without conversation beyond what the task required. The sluice box, a long, angled iron trough with riffles bolted at intervals across its base, had to be positioned precisely along the gradient of the valley floor to allow the maximum flow of water across the gold-bearing sediment she had excavated. From the clay beds, the water source was a narrow stream running along the northern ridge of the valley, which had not yet frozen solid at its central channel, and Halvard fabricated a simple iron diversion gate that redirected a controlled flow down through the sluice during working hours. The first washing run produced almost nothing visible. The second produced a faint, scattered showing of color in the lower riffles, small flecks, inconsistent, the kind of result that would have sent a less informed operator away from the site, concluding it was worthless. Cheryl read it differently. The scatter pattern in the riffles told her the primary deposit was not at the current excavation depth, it was below. The flecks were surface contamination from the upper clay beds, carried down through centuries of water movement. They were evidence of the deposit's existence, not its location. The main vein was sitting deeper, below the secondary clay horizon, protected by the dense geological cap that her father's journal had described, a hard, compressed band of calcified silt that would require significantly more effort to penetrate than the upper layers had. She recalculated her provisions. She had arrived with what she had estimated as 2 months of supplies, dried goods, salt meat, oats, dried legumes, a modest quantity of preserved fruit, candles, lamp oil, and a supply of coal for the iron stove sufficient for 6 weeks of steady burning. By the end of the second week of December, the coal supply was running lower than she had projected. The stove required more fuel in the extreme cold to maintain a temperature inside the stone hut that allowed her muscles to function the following morning. She rationed it carefully, allowing the interior temperature to drop during the late hours of the night when she was inside her bedroll and could survive the cold with insulation alone, reserving the full burn for the morning hours when she needed to restore feeling to her hands and prepare for the day's work. The food was a more pressing calculation. Physical labor in near-freezing conditions consumed provisions at a rate she had not fully accounted for, and by the third week of December, she was eating at a reduced level enough to sustain function, not enough to feel comfortable. She did not allow herself to fixate on this. She made her adjustments and continued. There were 3 days in the week before the Christmas period, when the temperature dropped to a level that made outdoor excavation genuinely dangerous. The kind of cold that settled into the valley like something solid and intentional, pressing through every layer of clothing and working against the body's capacity to stay warm and keep working at the same time. On those 3 days, Cheryl did not dig. She spent the hours inside the hut reviewing her father's journals, refining her depth calculations, and making detailed notes in her own working book about the sediment composition of each core sample she had extracted. She also spent a portion of each of those days on a task that required no outdoor exposure, the careful, painstaking process of cleaning, weighing, and recording every grain of recovered gold from the upper sluice runs, using a fine brass scale her father had kept in his surveying kit. The accumulated weight, by the end of December, was modest. It would not have impressed anyone who did not understand what it represented. But Cheryl understood exactly what it represented. It was proof. It was the surface expression of something much larger sitting below the calcified clay band, and it was enough, barely enough, but enough to fund what needed to happen next. The calcified band itself she reached in the first week of January, working with an iron pickhead Halvard had reforged to a sharper gauge for exactly this purpose. The band was approximately 14 inches thick and ran continuously across the lower section of the valley at a depth of just under 5 feet, exactly as her father's geological sketch had indicated. Penetrating it was the hardest physical work Cheryl had done in her life, harder than the initial excavation, harder than the sluice setup, harder than the frozen mornings when the ground had to be broken open inch by inch before it could be worked. She swung the pick for hours at a stretch, resting only when her arms lost the strength to lift it with any useful force, eating small portions at the brief midday halt, and continuing into the gray afternoon until the light failed completely. Halvard watched her work without comment for the first 2 days, On the third day, he took up a second pickhead of his own fabrication and worked the band beside her without being asked and without any discussion of whether this was within the scope of their agreement. On the ninth day of sustained effort, the pickhead broke through into a different quality of material. Cheryl stopped immediately. She crouched down and reached into the break with her bare hand, pulling up a handful of the material beneath the calcified band. It was dense, dark, heavily saturated clay, the kind of clay her father had described in the seventh journal as primary carrier material. She brought a handful of it to the light and turned it slowly in her palm. The gold was not in flakes anymore. It was in threads. Fine, heavy, continuous threads running through the clay like a natural weaving, visible to the naked eye even in the flat January light. Not scattered, not isolated, continuous. Cheryl looked at it for a long time without speaking. Halvard came and stood beside her and looked at it and also said nothing. After a while, Cheryl set the clay down carefully, cleaned her hand on her coat, and went back into the hut. She sat at the table, opened her working notebook, and began writing the most precise and detailed series of entries she had produced since arriving on the land. She wrote for 3 hours without stopping, until the candle burned low and she had to light a second one from the stub of the first. Then she went to sleep, because there was a great deal of work to do in the morning. By the end of February, Cheryl had accumulated enough verified gold yield to convert, at the private valuation of a reputable metals merchant in Leeds, whom she visited on a cold Wednesday under the name Miss S. Hartwell, into a sum that made the merchant look at her twice before he made the payment. He said nothing beyond what the transaction required. She accepted the payment in the form of a banker's draft, folded it into the inner pocket of her father's oilskin coat, and left the premises without conversation. She did not return to the valley immediately. She took the overnight coach south. London, in late February, was gray and cold and smelled of coal smoke and wet stone. Cheryl had been there once before, as a child, when her father had made a professional journey to the city and brought her along. She remembered it as enormous and indifferent a place that was entirely uninterested in who you were unless you could demonstrate some form of leverage over it. That, she had come to understand, was not so different from the northern counties. The difference was scale. In London, the indifference was simply operated at a higher volume. She had done her research before the journey. Aldous Vane, the Duke's estate manager, had been placing notices in the London property intelligence sheets for over a year, quiet, business-like notices advertising the availability of mortgaged parcels from the Miller estate for debt satisfaction. Three parcels adjacent to Cheryl's Valley had outstanding mortgages held by two separate London lending houses, both of which had been managing defaulted payments from the Duke's estate accounts for the better part of 14 months. The lending houses were not sentimental about land values. They were interested in recovering principal, an offer at a reasonable discount to the outstanding mortgage balance, settled immediately in full, was exactly the kind of transaction a lending house in that position found agreeable. Cheryl made her appointments through a solicitor's office in Holborn, conducting the meetings in the identity of Miss S. Hartwell, a northern property investor acting on behalf of a private land consolidation interest. The solicitor, a calm, efficient man named Phineas Good, who asked no more questions than the transaction required, managed the paperwork with professional discretion. Cheryl paid him well for both qualities. The first mortgage acquisition took one afternoon. The second required a second visit the following morning, during which the lending house's representative attempted a brief renegotiation that Cheryl addressed by standing up from her chair, closing her document case, and informing the representative, in a tone of complete and unhurried finality, that her offer would remain open until noon and that she had another appointment at 1. The representative capitulated by 11:30. She returned north on the late coach with documentation giving her legal claim over 3 adjacent parcels totaling, in combination with her original valley purchase, nearly 900 acres of the former Miller estate's northern territory. She had done it quietly, quickly, and entirely within legal means. The Duke's estate office would not receive notification of the mortgage transfers for several weeks, by which time the registration would be complete and the transfers entirely irreversible. She was back at work in the valley by the following Thursday. The rumor reached Duke Benjamin Miller in March, which was later than it might have reached a more attentive man. It came to him through the kind of casual social exchange that moves information through the gentry, a comment made at a dinner table by a land agent who had heard from a farrier, who had heard from a farmer whose field bordered the Dye, southern edge of the valley, that there was heavy ironwork going into the Dawson parcel, and that there had been a cart running back and forth from Grafen in the winter months, and that there was smoke from the chimney of the old stone hut at all hours. The Duke listened to this with the particular attention of a man whose relationship with his own financial situation had recently become unavoidable. His London creditors had moved from polite correspondence to formal legal notices in the intervening months, and Aldous Vane had presented him with a revised estate assessment that had produced, for the first time, a response from the Duke that was not dismissal but something closer to alarm. He had sold the northern parcels because they were worthless. That had been the entire point. If something was now happening on one of those parcels, he intended to understand what it was and whether any portion of it could be recovered to his benefit. He sent three men to investigate, not official representatives, not solicitors, but physical men of the kind that a certain type of nobleman keeps employed under ambiguous titles that do not appear in formal household accounts. Their instruction was to assess what was being built on the valley parcel and report back. If the current occupant could be persuaded to abandon the property, so much the better. They arrived on a gray Thursday afternoon and found the valley considerably more developed than any of them had anticipated. There was a functioning sluice operation running along the lower valley section, a secondary excavation site with timber shoring at the eastern end, a tool storage lean-to of new construction against the stone hut's north wall, and Halvard Crewe, who was a large and entirely unperturbed man, standing at the entrance to the hut with no visible expression and a heavy iron-handled implement resting across his forearm in a manner that was not precisely a threat, but was also not a threat. Cheryl came out of the hut behind him. She was holding a document. The document was a formal copy of the Crown Mining Charter, applicable to the Northern Highland Territories, the same ancient charter she had located during her research at the County Registrar's Office, the same provision she had identified in the contract clause that Reginald Frost had included as a formality and no one else had read. The charter established, in language that was old but unambiguous, that the holder of a valid land deed in the specified Northern Territory possessed absolute mineral extraction rights on that land, independent of any regional lord, and that those rights were protected under Crown authority and could not be superseded by local ducal claim or estate recovery proceedings. She handed the document to the lead man. He looked at it for longer than was comfortable, in the way that people look at things they can read but cannot immediately find a way around. Then he looked at Halvard, then back at the document. The three men departed before sunset. They returned to the Duke with a full report that included, among other things, the information that the woman he had publicly laughed at in the mud had apparently spent the intervening months doing something rather more productive than he had assumed. Duke Benjamin Miller sat with this information for several days. Then he instructed Vane to send a formal letter to the Dawson property, inquiring about the nature of the operations being conducted on the land. Cheryl received the letter, read it, set it on the table beside her working notebook, and did not reply. The Crown Assay Master arrived in the second week of April. His name was Cornelius Ashby, a senior official from the Crown's Mineral Assessment Office, a compact, precise man in his mid-50s, who had spent 30 years evaluating mineral claims across the northern and western territories of England. He did not travel cheaply or quickly. He arrived with two junior assessors, a geological technician, and a set of professional testing instruments that required their own transport case. The journey had been initiated by Cheryl's formal submission to the Crown Minerals Office in March, a submission that included documented core sample data, sluice yield records, sediment analysis notes drawn from her father's journals and her own working book, and a small sealed package containing a representative selection of the gold specimens she had recovered from the primary vein. The submission had been processed without particular urgency by the Minerals Office, which received a considerable volume of prospecting claims every year, and had developed a professional skepticism toward them. Cheryl's submission had been placed in the assessment queue in the usual manner. What moved it forward was the quality of the documentation, the depth and technical precision of the geological analysis, the methodical yield records, and the purity of the specimen samples, which the office's preliminary assessor had noted in his internal report as significantly above average for self-directed prospecting operations. Cornelius Ashby had reviewed that report himself and requested the full file. Then he had arranged the site visit personally rather than delegating it to a junior team. The assessment took 4 days. Ashby and his team worked the valley systematically, running independent core samples at 43 separate points across the excavation area, conducting water table and gradient analyses, collecting sediment specimens from the primary vein exposure at 3 different points along its visible length, and performing a complete re-evaluation of the upper and lower clay bed composition. Halvard stayed out of their way and kept working. Cheryl provided the team with full access to her documentation and answered every technical question with the kind of detailed, referenced precision that made Ashby's junior assessors exchange glances on the second day. On the 4th afternoon, Ashby stood at the primary vein exposure in the lower valley and looked at it for a long time without writing anything in his notebook. He was a man who had evaluated perhaps 200 mineral sites in his career. He had a developed and reliable instinct for the difference between a promising finding and a genuinely significant one. The assessment report was completed and submitted to the Crown Minerals office within the fortnight. Ashby exercised his authority as senior assay master to request an expedited formal valuation hearing, citing the exceptional nature of the deposit. The hearing was convened at the Regional Mining Exchange office in the county town on a Thursday in late April, a formal proceeding, open to registered industry representatives, estate agents, and any party with a legal or financial interest in the surrounding territory. The room was not large, but it was full. The news that a formal Crown assay hearing had been convened for the Dawson Valley parcel had moved through the county with the speed that financial information tends to move when it concerns a reversal of expected fortune. Mining investors, estate representatives, legal agents, and a number of people who simply wanted to be present for reasons of social interest had assembled by the time Ashby called the proceedings to order. Duke Benjamin was not present. He had been informed of the hearing through official channels and had sent Reginald Frost in his place, which was perhaps the clearest possible indication that he had not yet understood what was about to happen. Cheryl sat at the claimant's table in her plain wool dress, her working notebook open in front of her, and listened as Cornelius Ashby read the assessment findings aloud. The technical language was dense and precise, but the figures it contained were not. The primary gold vein in the Dawson Valley parcel was, per independent Crown assessment, the richest alluvial gold deposit identified in the Northern Highland Territories in over 100 years. The verified yield from the initial extraction phase, combined with the projected yield of the unmined vein section as assessed through core sampling, placed the total estimated value of the deposit at a figure that produced absolute silence in the room when Ashby stated it. A silence of the particular quality that assembles when a large number of people simultaneously revise their understanding of something they thought they already knew. Reginald Frost, who had stood in the mud of that valley 5 months earlier and witnessed the contract that transferred it for £500, sat very still at the back of the room, with the expression of a man who is performing an extremely unwelcome arithmetic in his head. Ashby concluded by formally registering the claim under the Crown Charter provision, confirming Cheryl Dawson as the sole and legally protected operator of the Dawson Mining Works, and entering the assessment findings into the permanent Crown Mineral Record. Cheryl thanked him, closed her working notebook, and stood up from the table. Duke Benjamin Miller came to the valley on a Thursday morning in May, and he came alone. No carriage. No entourage. No Reginald Frost carrying documents. No Lady Dorothea standing nearby to enjoy the spectacle. He came on horseback along the northern track, dismounted at the ridge above the valley, and walked down through the mud on foot, which was, in its own way, the most honest thing he had done in connection with this land. The valley he entered was unrecognizable from the one he had laughed over in October. The sluice operation had expanded significantly, A secondary processing structure built from new timber stood at the valley's eastern end. A path of flat stones had been laid from the stone hut to the working area to allow movement across the wet ground without losing footing. There were tool racks, a covered materials store, a water management channel running precisely along the slope of the lower ridge. The whole thing had the organized, purposeful appearance of an operation that had been designed carefully, built methodically, and run by someone who understood exactly what they were doing at every stage. Cheryl was standing outside the stone hut when he came down the path. She was in her working clothes, the practical gray dress, the heavy coat, her dark hair pulled back without decoration. She looked as she had looked every day on that land for the past 7 months, competent, unadorned, and completely at ease in surroundings that had been built by her own effort. The Duke looked different from the man who had thrown his head back and laughed in October. Not physically diminished, he was still a tall, well-built man, but something in the quality of his bearing had changed in a way that was difficult to name precisely and very easy to recognize. The absolute, unconsidered confidence that had been his defining characteristic was simply no longer there. What had replaced it was something more complicated. A man who has been required by events to reassess himself and has found the process neither quick nor comfortable. He stood in the mud at a respectful distance and looked at the operation around him for a moment before he spoke. When he did speak, he did not attempt to position the conversation as anything other than what it was. He told her that he had misjudged the land. He said this directly, without softening it into something easier to produce. Then he told her that he had misjudged her, and that this was the more significant error of the two. Cheryl listened to this without changing her expression. The business between them was this. The Duke's financial situation had completed its journey from serious to catastrophic. The London creditors had moved to formal recovery proceedings. The remaining mortgaged parcels of the Miller estate, those not yet sold, not yet in other hands, were subject to legal claim, and the Duke had, under legal advisement from a solicitor who was more honest with him than Reginald Frost had ever been, determined that a voluntary structured settlement was preferable to a forced dissolution. The remaining northern parcels, four of them, running along the eastern and southern edges of the valley, were to be sold at assessed value to settle the priority debts. Cheryl had already made the offer through Phineas Goode's office in London. It had been a fair offer, assessed at current market value. Without the inflated premium, her legal position would have justified, and which she had deliberately excluded, because she had not built this enterprise on the basis of taking more than what the work warranted. The Duke produced the documents from his coat. Halvard brought a board and a pen from the stone hut without being asked. Duke Benjamin looked at the documents for a moment, and then he looked at the valley around them, the working sluice, the careful stone path, the organized structures, all of it built on ground. He had laughed at, and something crossed his face that was neither pride nor anger, but something more private and more final than either. An accounting, perhaps. The specific weight of a man finally understanding the full cost of a particular quality of certainty. He signed his name. Cheryl signed below it, in the same clean, clear strokes she had used in October when she signed her £500 away on a frozen Wednesday morning and received an iron key to a muddy wasteland in return. The transaction was complete. She extended her hand. He took it not warmly, but honestly, which was the right way for that particular exchange to be concluded. He walked back up the valley path alone and mounted his horse at the ridge. Cheryl watched him go without expression, then turned back to look at the valley, all of it now, from the northern stream to the eastern ridge, nearly 1,200 acres of land that she had assembled, parcel by parcel, over 7 months, from a starting point of £500 and 14 worn leather journals her father had left her. Halvard came and stood beside her. He looked at the valley, too, in his comfortable, unhurried manner. After a while, Cheryl picked up her working notebook from the hut doorstep and opened it to a fresh page. There was more work to do. There is something that needs to be said before this story ends, and it is not about gold. Cheryl Dawson did not win because she was lucky. She did not succeed because something fell into her hands that she did not earn. She succeeded because she kept her father's journals when the world told her they were worthless, because she read them every night when she had no particular reason to believe they would ever be useful to anyone, because when the single opportunity appeared cold, muddy, and dressed up as a bad investment, she recognized it for what it was, and she moved toward it without flinching. She was cold for months. She was hungry more days than she was comfortable. She worked until her hands ached, and her back refused to straighten easily, and the candle burned down to a stub in the small hours of the morning while she was still writing in her notebook. Not one person believed in what she was doing. Not one person came to help her until she had already found the proof herself. If you have watched this story to this point, if something in it made you sit forward, or go quiet, or feel the weight of what it means to carry knowledge that the world does not yet value, then you already know why this channel exists. Drop a comment below and tell me where you are watching from. Tell me what part of this story stayed with you. That simple act, your comment, your location, your honest reaction keeps stories like this one coming. It tells the platform that these stories matter, and they do matter. If you are not yet subscribed to Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles, do it now. Not for an algorithm, not for a number, but because what is waiting in this library of stories is exactly what Cheryl found under 5 feet of frozen Yorkshire mud. Something real. Something that was always there, waiting for the person who was willing to look. Like this story. Share it with someone who needs to hear it tonight. Hit the notification bell so you are here when the next one begins. Welcome, properly and finally, to the family.